Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Feigenbaum.
Thank you. My pleasure. Always good to be with the Voice of America.
Thank you. Secretary Kerry is going to all the political capitals in the region, but then when he goes to Uzbekistan, he goes to Samarkand. Why Samarkand? Do you think that was a strategic choice?
No, I think it was probably a mutually agreeable choice. I mean, he's going to all the political capitals, except in Uzbekistan, which suggests that that was a choice that was agreeable to the government of Uzbekistan, and that's not surprising. It's the president's hometown, President Karimov. It's also a place with terrific visuals and probably a place that the government of Uzbekistan is very proud of. And so I think probably the combination of the backdrop and the history.
They're going to have a new dialogue formatted as Central Asia 5+1. And that's where Secretary Kerry wants to stress on the fact that U.S. wants to continue and will continue promoting regional integration, something that, as you know, a lot of people, even here in Washington, are quite cynical about. What's your thinking?
Well, I would kind of take those two in turn. First, the idea of a 5+1, and then the regional integration theme. You know, on the 5+1, I think it's terrific. You know, it's fine and good that the United States is going to do all five countries plus one at the ministerial level. And I noticed that there have been some kind of ad hoc informal meetings like that on the margins of the United Nations General Assembly and so on. But, I mean, we should say two things about that. First, it's not a particularly original idea. After all, Japan has had a Central Asia plus one at the ministerial level for many, many years. And there are other countries that do the same. So, in fact, the United States has been the exception to the rule. And so it's really converging toward a format that we've seen with a lot of other countries. The other thing to say is that this is not wholly original, because the United States has had Central Asia 5+1 forums before. When I was in the government in the mid-2000s, we had a so-called TIFA, a Trade and Investment Framework Agreement with Central Asia. And that was the only regional as opposed to bilateral TIFA that the United States had at that time. So that was a structure that also put the U.S. together with all five together. So it's a good initiative, but it's not particularly original, but I'm glad it's happening. I'm suspecting the reason that they're moving toward that format is because, as you said, they want to put the emphasis on regional integration and try to inject the United States more directly into that conversation. That's not a new agenda either, and you know that because you've been covering this forever. I mean, it goes back even, you know, not just to the Bush administration, but to the Clinton administration. People have been talking about this for a long time. And it's easy, as you said, people are cynical about it. And they're cynical about it, I think, for two reasons. One is because they think it's been mostly talk rather than action, and I think that's largely true. And second, because the enthusiasm for it among outside powers like the United States has been much greater than among the countries themselves. And that is also true. But just because people are cynical about it and it's hard doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong agenda. And I would say, you know, you don't have to look very far. You can look at World Bank economic data to see that non-cooperation on a regional basis, not just in Central Asia, but in Africa and other regions of the world, yields a lot of costs to growth. For one thing, it erects transaction costs that knock, you know, a point or more off your GDP growth before you even get started looking at the underlying drivers of growth. So I think, you know, prior to 1991, regional cooperation was easier in this part of the world because things could just be decided in Moscow by administrative fiat. And so it's harder, and we all know, if we follow the region, the tensions and obstacles and lack of enthusiasm and difficulties. But I think there are a number of areas where it's going to be important to build a more regional basis. And that's where I think China and Japan in particular come into the region in interesting ways, because they are doing things, I think, where the United States has brought less to the table in terms of tangible action or tangible money. So they make that agenda a little bit more interesting, China in particular.
And Secretary Kerry is going to cover all of the countries. A lot of issues to raise, obviously. Human rights organizations are reaching out to the State Department. There are lots of expectations in Central Asia, too. And off your Twitter, I'm reading something where you say, I wish the substance got as much focus as how many countries they landed in one trip. Do you think this was a really difficult trip to plan? We know that this was a long time coming. What does it take to have Secretary of State to visit a region like Central Asia, which is not necessarily a priority, area for Washington?
Well, it's happened before. I mean, Secretary Powell went there. Secretary Rice went there. I believe Secretary Clinton went there. So Secretaries of State do visit. They just haven't been to all five on the same trip. And I think that's what people have been touting. And I guess if you're touting a 5+1 structure, then that's one reason why you want to go to all five. When I said I wish I said on a tweet that I did on Twitter that I wish they focused on the substance just as much as they do on the number of countries. I just meant that, you don't want things to get the feel of a box-checking exercise, that you want to touch down in every country to say that you did it. And I think there is that danger. I mean, in fact, Secretary Gary is not the only one who will have been to all five. Prime Minister Modi of India went to all five. Prime Minister Abe of Japan just went to all five. And if you want to see what I mean in action, I think one leader of the world who has not been to all five on the same trip is President Xi Jinping of China, who has been to some of these countries, but not to all five on the same trip. And even though he hasn't been to all five on the same trip, I would argue that China is much more active and in many ways much more effective on its interests, as it defines them in the region, than some of these other powers are. So you don't want just going there to be kind of a box check. You really need to drill down on the substance. And, your point about all the different issues and agendas that are going to be on the trip, that's as it should be. I mean, we've talked about that in interviews that we've done before. The U.S. doesn't have the luxury of having a one-dimensional policy. And so I think probably all these issues are going to come up. There'll be security dimension and business dimension, hopefully with an investment dimension. That's harder for the U.S. than it is for China, for reasons that we can talk about. But also a human rights and political dimension and other dimensions, too. But again, you don't want that to feel like a box check either, where you just do the same thing in every country and you're just substituting in names of different companies, names of different human rights cases, and so on. So, I hope they really drill down on the substance and they don't get too wrapped around the axle just by the mere fact that they're touching down in all the countries.
What we hear a lot from U.S. diplomats is that China and Russia obviously are big neighbors. Central Asian countries need to deal with them, and it's good that they're bringing in investment, especially China. And Russia's role will always be unique. We're not competing with them, but we want to be a reliable partner. We want to be there for Central Asians as a good option. Do you believe in that when you hear those kind of statements? Do they mean anything for you? Because you've been there, you've dealt with Central Asians, you have dealt with Russian pressure in the region, influence in the region, and of course, even during your time, China was already growing big in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to it. I mean, the countries themselves, Kazakhstan talks about having a multi-vector foreign policy. Other countries have talked about it. I was in Mongolia last week, which is not in Central Asia defined as the five, but it's kind of roughly in the region. And it was formerly closely linked to the Soviet Union. I mean, they talk about having a third neighbor policy. It's the same idea as multi-vector. I think for the countries in the region themselves, there's something to be said for having relationships with as many outside powers as you can. And people talk about a great game a lot. And I never really loved that metaphor because it suggests that countries are kind of this object that's acted upon by the outside powers, when in fact we know that they are not just object, they are subject, and that some of them have been quite adept at turning the competition of outside powers to their own advantage in terms of maximizing their own leverage or bargaining power. I mean, if you look at the way certain Central Asian countries have used China's growing role, for instance, as bargaining leverage with Russian partners in certain areas of business, you can see how having more options than other outside powers does that. But, I mean, your point about being geographically proximate countries for China and Russia, I mean, that's just reality. So you were mentioning regional integration as a big U.S. agenda. And, I mean, if regional integration means infrastructure, roads and bridges and things like that, I mean, the fact is you can't build a bridge or a highway from Tajikistan across the Pacific Ocean to the United States, but you can to China. So there are just certain geographic realities that I think are going to give China a bigger role in that space. And if the United States wants to play in that space, it has to figure out a way to maximize its own strengths. Because if it tries to pretend it's geographically contiguous or to try to compete dollar for dollar That's hard, too. I mean, you know, part of one of the things that China has as an advantage is that they have this extremely extensive system of state-backed project finance through state-backed development banks and state-owned enterprises. And the United States just doesn't do that. And so, you know, you can't really compare apples to apples. So the U.S. has, I think, struggled over a decade or more to find a role for itself in this discussion about regional integration where it brings something tangible to the table. When it's not geographically contiguous, it doesn't have as much money, it isn't state-backed project finance and so on. And I think the U.S. is still looking for that role, frankly.
We've been hearing something a lot recently, which is investing in human capital in Central Asia. That's something that we have heard from Assistant Secretary Nisha Biswal when she talked about the region and other leading diplomats too. But we don't necessarily observe stronger or increasing political will to invest. China is investing because it's close, but we don't see U.S. Thinking of doing anything more than what it is doing now, which is basically limiting itself with assistance programs.
Well, I think that's a problem. You know, I mean, China is investing, but China's investing largely with hard infrastructure and with hard money and cash. And so the point that you brought up, which is more about soft infrastructure and human capital. So that could be training, it could be English language, it could be other ways of linking to the global economy, it could be innovation, it could be technology. Those are strengths that the United States has uniquely. In fact, just look at China. Everybody talks about how China is doing all this investment in Central Asia. But I mean, where are Chinese students going? You know, there are more students from China in the United States than from any other country.
There are so many Chinese students here in the United States because they can afford financially to study here. But for Central Asians, to come and study here in big numbers means either U.S. is going to pay for that education or the countries will have to invest.
That's right. So, I mean, you know, you yourself are an example, I think, of where the, if I'm not mistaken, of where the United States paid because you were a recipient of a U.S. fellowship. But, you know, there are cases where the governments have done that. I think about the Balashakh program in Kazakhstan, for example. I mean, it's not an accident. When I worked at Harvard University before I went into the government, there are a number of people who are currently senior officials in the government of Kazakhstan that I knew when they were not so senior way back in the day. They were Mason Fellows at the Kennedy School at Harvard, or they were doing other things there. And I met them when they were, you know, younger versions of their current selves. And so the reason for that is that, you know, that's an example of a government that did invest through a program. I think some of the governments in the region are more mistrustful, frankly, of overseas education and of these sorts of educational opportunities. I've never really been able to explain that. I mean, is it a function of kind of closed regime types? Well, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, China has a closed political system as well. It's definitely a Leninist-style political system that owes much to, you know, dominated by Communist Party, that owes much to China's past. The economy is increasingly open, and society is more open than it was many decades ago, but the political system still has many Leninist overtones. But the Chinese government has found a way to leverage overseas education to its advantage, whether it's in Canada or Australia or Great Britain. And so it seems to me that Central Asian governments could do that too. And especially in countries, you know, there are some countries that have very strong youth bulges. You have young demographics. I mean, so, you know, you need to invest in talent. And it seems to me that whether it's in the country or it's overseas, that's something that, you know, would be a good agenda for the United States and some other countries. But I think it's been handicapped by lack of political will, as you said, on the U.S. side, and lack of money. But, you know, and also that Central Asia is more distant in some ways intellectually for Americans than China. But on the Central Asian side, it's been handicapped by political factors and mistrust, with one or two countries being the exceptions.
Well, speaking of mistrust and investment, I'm sure you've seen the recent story of how U.S. government has refused to allow South Korea to export $400 million worth of supersonic training jets, basically fighter jets, to Uzbekistan. What did you think of that?
I find it completely unsurprising. That plane is an indigenous Korean plane, but it includes technology from Lockheed Martin, which is an American company. And in cases where there's American technology in an overseas plane, there are, not just for Uzbekistan, but for many potential customers, a lot of controls on technology. So I didn't find that very surprising at all. I think it's of a piece with a lot of what I've seen globally, not just in Central Asia.
You know, the bigger question is, and we've been talking about it for days now, why would Uzbekistan need such jets? I mean, we're talking about 12 of them, but they are expensive. For a country like Uzbekistan to spend almost $500 million to get fighter jets. Of course, you know, we can't get any questions answered from Tashkent, or Uzbek diplomats won't comment on that. But you know South Korea. You know that they're selling this to countries like Iraq. They're selling it to other places where, you know, we have wars, I mean, serious conflicts. But Uzbekistan, why would they think of needing this?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate on their motives. I mean, you should ask them if you could get them to answer. I mean, I think lots of countries, you know, want modern militaries equipped with the latest and the best, and it's partly a status symbol, and it's partly about how they think about their force planning. You know, I don't know who the Koreans have sold the jets to. I haven't followed it that closely, either that particular aircraft. And I don't follow South Korean defense industry that closely, except to say that Korea, much like Japan, is interested in being a technology exporter, including of indigenously produced high-tech and defense technology. And so, you know, in Japan, for example, you're seeing that now with debate about whether Japan is going to play a role in Australia's next generation submarine development. And even that's been, you know, that's in a way been controversial, more on the Australian side, because Australia has indigenization requirements. But, I mean, these are two, you know, U.S. plus U.S. allies in the Pacific, and it's not a foregone conclusion that Japan will play that role in the next generation of Collins-class submarine development in Australia. So I think all of these kind of weapons and procurement decisions, especially where they involve cross-national development of technology, it's always sensitive, and there are a lot of issues raised. And the United States is particularly careful when its technology is involved, no matter who the point of origin is of the final, you know, system.
You know, when people criticize China in Central Asia, they usually say, we know that Chinese leaders come to the region, and we know that they're making a lot of deals with our governments. In countries like Kyrgyzstan, for example, you know, how come our roads are not getting better? How come the services are not getting better? Where is that money going? And of course, you know, they're not getting answers to those questions, and they're kind of used to not getting those answers too. But then Japan comes, billions of dollars worth of agreements with Uzbekistan and with other neighboring countries. How different is Japan from China in terms of investing?
Yeah, I think on China, I mean, we do see where some of those dollars are going. After all, there's an oil pipeline from Kazakhstan that runs to China, and there's a gas pipeline that runs from Turkmenistan to China through several other countries. And those are important projects because, after all, until that Chinese pipeline came along, I mean, all of the Turkmen gas basically went to Russia. And so that issue for Turkmenistan of being overly dependent on a Russian monopsony. You know, the United States and Europeans talked for years about Turkmen gas running westward, and in the event that gas is running eastward. So it was China that played that role, and that was largely through infrastructure finance of the type that China is saying it now wants to do, not just in oil and gas, but in mining and in other areas too. You know, for China, before I get to Japan, for China, people talk about this One Belt, One Road initiative, and there are just eye-popping sums of money supposedly attached to that, whether it's through this $40 billion bilateral Silk Road Fund, or it's the potential money that goes multilaterally, but from China with its huge stake in the New Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. You know, the numbers are eye-popping, and frankly, the numbers that are pledged have been larger than the numbers that have actually been dispensed to some of these countries. A lot of what China is doing under One Belt, One Road actually that long predates One Belt, One Road. And as you said earlier, China's role in the region, you could see it as early as the 1990s. It really began to change the face of the region because while, you know, borders got erected between Central Asian countries and that made things more complicated for them, this border with China fell metaphorically. And so you could trade across that border and you could see investment across that border in ways that I think have the potential to be greatly to the advantage of the countries in terms of bargaining power with certain others. But also, if the pledges become real, and if it's not done in a way that fosters over-dependence on China or the use of economic leverage for political gain for China at the expense of the countries, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with roads and infrastructure. That could be a good thing. So we'll see. But, I mean, remember, some of this is quite self-interested for China. For instance, a lot of Chinese firms are looking to export overcapacity. There's a huge glut of steel. There's basically, you know, a loss of demand for steel, and there's too much steel sitting in China. So Chinese firms are delighted to export that overcapacity to infrastructure projects backed by the Chinese government and state-backed project finance incentivizers that use Chinese steel. So that's the opportunity that a lot of Chinese firms see in One Belt, One Road. And so this could be good, but Central Asian countries have to turn it to their advantage. Now, Japan, I think, ironically, brings some of the same tools to the region that China has. One is project finance with a kind of state connection through JBIC, which is the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. And Japan's evolved a lot in how it does project finance. But if you go back several decades, some of what China's doing today, we saw in patterns that Japan used 30, 40 years ago in its overseas project finance. I mean, the good news, I'm a big enthusiast of Japan's role in the region for two reasons. One, I think they hit all of the buckets of interest. They have a strategic interest because, like the United States, they want to help Central Asian countries have more options. Second, they're an Asian country not called China. And so to help foster links between Central Asia and Asia, particularly to the east, you know, you need more than just China in play. And so the good news is Japan, but also South Korea and South Korean investment have been in play. This predates Prime Minister Abe as well. In fact, when I was in the government in the mid-2000s, we quite expanded the U.S.-Japan consultation mechanism on Central Asia, which had previously just been foreign ministries. And we added in the commerce ministries. We added in the foreign assistance agencies. We also added in the JBIC. And that's because we were looking, I think, to see whether Japan could play this more multidimensional role. So that's the good news. Japan gets all those baskets and brings a lot of dollars that Prime Minister Abe pledged, but also some strategic interests. And that's partly a function of his eye being on China. But I think Prime Minister Abe and the current Japanese government are going to face some of the same obstacles that previous Japanese governments encountered. One is really making more tangible and real the interests of Japanese companies in the region. The investment just hasn't been there. In fact, South Korea, I think, has been further in front of Japan. So theoretically, the interest is there, but you need to make that real. And then also there's just the lack of geographical being contiguous the way China is. So I think that, you know, that's going to be a challenge, but I think it's terrific that he did the visit. And it signals a new level of interest in Japan and, frankly, an opportunity for the U.S. and Japan to collaborate as well. What I mean by cooperation is not necessarily work jointly. I mean work in complementary ways. I mean, I have no illusions that everything the U.S. and Japan might do in Central Asia needs to be done together. The point is just if the U.S. and Japan are working separately but in complementary ways toward the same goals, for instance, to foster the growth of market reforms in the economic area, I think that would be a positive thing. So, you know, for example, just want me to make that real for you and not theoretical. There's this thing called CARIC, the Central Asia Regional Economic Cooperation Program, and it predates a lot of this regional integration. It's run by the Asian Development Bank and includes a lot of the right players. It's got a lot of the right countries. It's got Central Asian countries, China, Azerbaijan. It's got many development banks, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, European Bank for Reconstruction Development. I think the Islamic Development Bank is in there. So it's got countries and it's got financial players. So there's an example of a mechanism that if that can't work, then how can you make anything else work? But CARIC has struggled for reasons that you pointed out before and that we talked about before. Cooperation in Central Asia is just hard. And a lot of this is hard. It requires levels of political agreement and consensus that don't exist. It requires a lot of money and project finance that, you know, China's frankly putting up more than the development banks are. So that's the challenge. But now to make it real on the U.S. and Japan, when I was in the U.S. government, we had this idea to piggyback on CARIC. So rather than just talking about, oh, the U.S. and regional integration, we said, well, why don't we piggyback and enhance the efforts of an existing mechanism? So you have this CARIC that already includes a lot of the right countries and the banks. Why don't we create a CARIC plus three, the plus three being the U.S., Japan, and the European Union, which were the three big market economies in the world, one, two, and three at that time, till China recently surpassed Japan. And so here was an opportunity for the big market players to play in the region in a coordinated way, leveraging existing vehicles, rather than just kind of running around randomly talk and dig about integration, but without really finding a way to make it real. Now, in the event, it didn't work. And it didn't work, I'm I will tell you candidly, because the Europeans torpedoed that idea. That was an American idea, and the Japanese were on board with it, and the Europeans didn't like it. And I think the Europeans didn't like it because, if I'm not mistaken, Russia is not part of CARIC, and the Europeans at that time were quite worried about what the Russian reaction to it would be. I didn't think the Russian reaction would be that uncomfortable because the Russians, in theory, were promoting some of the same things as CARIC, but also because Russia was trying to get into CARIC at the time, and so I thought there might be a way to make that work. But the point was that the U.S. and Japan, and in that case the European Union, could have piggybacked on a mechanism where their cooperation would have been complementary and more tangible, rather than just, you know, parachuting in, visiting the five countries, talking a lot about regional integration. But it didn't work, and it didn't work for, well, you know, political reasons and other reasons that are hard. But that's what I mean. That's the kind of example, I think, that the government should be looking for how to kind of work in complementary ways and enhance their roles on integration. And if you're the U.S. and you're an outside player, maybe CARIC isn't the right vehicle. Maybe there's some other vehicle. But you need a vehicle, because the U.S. isn't going to have the money. And I think partly why you, from Washington and many others, are so cynical about the U.S. is, you know, I mean, look, before the Obama administration was talking, I was in the Bush administration. You used to interview me, and I talked about all this stuff. But it's hard for a distant power with not as much money to make that real. And the way to make that real, I think, is to reinforce your own strengths by piggybacking on the strengths of others. And that's what I mean by coordination and complementarity. Well, and use an instrument like a CARIC that already exists, rather than creating one. It's always easier to use something that exists than to create it from scratch. But, you know, that was a big idea, and it didn't work.
Why didn't TIFA work?
So there are limitations on a TIFA. I mean, what is a TIFA? You know, a TIFA is U.S. Trade Representative-led forum that can be, frankly, anything that the countries in question want it to be. It's not like negotiating a free trade agreement or negotiating a bilateral investment treaty. It's not a treaty or agreement or a vehicle with requirements. It's just a dialogue forum. And so, you know, frankly, I'm kind of I'm a man of action, I guess. I prefer action to dialogues for their own sake. And I think dialogues are great if they're action forcing, but I've never been a big fan of dialogue mechanisms in the absence of other things. And so whether it's TIFA or, frankly, it's these ABCs, the annual bilateral consultations, it's great. I mean, it's important to have those mechanisms. And that was, you know, an innovation that the current administration had, that we didn't have annual bilateral consultations, but we did have a lot of consultations bilaterally and often annually, sometimes more than annually. But the point is that, I don't know, my preference and my bias has always been that you start with work plans and then you use the dialogue mechanisms as the implementing agent for the work plans. If you start with the dialogue mechanism and then have to come up with a work plan, you know, then why are you meeting? You're just meeting to meet. So I think maybe that's one problem that TIFA had. I also think that, you know, decentralization was not the highest priority for a U.S. Trade Representative, because U.S. Trade Representative is a very small office. It doesn't have a lot of people in it compared to, say, the Defense Department or the State Department. And so for a small agency that has to cover the entire world and that has very, very big and important responsibilities to negotiate major, you know, bilateral free trade agreements and investment agreements, you know, it just kind of falls through the cracks. But it was a good initiative. And as I said, before there was this idea of a Central Asia 5 plus 1 ministerial, let's not pretend the U.S. hasn't done that before. That's what the TIFA was. It just wasn't at the ministerial level, but it was the U.S. and all five together, and it happened several times. And I think by the end, it was becoming more business-oriented. So rather than just a dialogue mechanism, for instance, there was the government-to-government meeting, and then there would be a second meeting at the Chamber of Commerce, and then there'd be a third meeting where the private sector would come in as a public-private. And that was an innovation that, when I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, we introduced, because we wanted to make it more public-private. And so USTR and state and others came up with this idea, and we tried to do that. But, I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you just have a dialogue.
I remember covering many TIFA events here in Washington. I remember roundtables with the ministers of finance, ministers of trade and investment from Central Asia. They used to make some interesting discussions. Yes,
but they were just discussions, right? I mean, they weren't. You know, you got to make it real. And I think U.S. firms, because we talked about this with China, the U.S. doesn't do large-scale state-backed project finance. China does. So the U.S. can't compete apples to apples. It has to compete apples to oranges. And what the U.S. brings is its strength as the private sector. And so that means, you know, that becomes cliche if the private sector doesn't actually want to invest there. And, I mean, frankly, there hasn't been enough private sector investment from the U.S. and Central Asia. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One is political risk. Another is fluctuations in the, you know, the commodities markets, oil, gas, metals. A third is distance, priorities. A fourth, frankly, is the global financial crisis, because after 2008, a lot of U.S. companies began to retrench. If you look at oil and gas companies, for instance, they began to focus much more on domestic sources like shale gas and scaled, and in some cases, scaled back their overseas investments. So I think both structurally and for reasons that have to do with kind of risk in the region, Central Asia is not as easy a place for U.S. firms to do business as East Asia or India. And, you know, even India is not always an easy place to do business. It's been a hard place for U.S. firms in the last 2 years. So that's the problem. And so what you're stuck with then is just a dialogue. And at the end of the day, a dialogue is just a dialogue.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.